Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This week, the U.S. Supreme Court heard back-to-back oral arguments on two gay rights cases, California's Proposition 8 and the Defense of Marriage Act. These two cases have received wall-to-wall media coverage. And later in the show, we'll be joined by Lisa Keen, chief correspondent for the Keen News Agency, to talk about coverage she's been reporting for the gay community since 1979. On Tuesday, North Dakota's Republican Governor Jack Daringpole signed the most restrictive abortion laws in the country. One would essentially ban abortion. It bans abortion as soon as a fetal heartbeat is detected, something that can happen as nearly as 6 weeks in. The bill also imposes the first state ban on abortion based on genetic defects such as Down syndrome. It also makes it more difficult for a doctor to perform an abortion by requiring those who do to have hospital-admitting privileges. This is incredibly difficult because, as you probably know, so many doctors fly into states like North Dakota to perform abortions. And this got a lot of coverage also this week. And joining us to talk about it is Kate Shepard, staff reporter in Mother Jones Washington Bureau. Hi, Kate. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And we've got Kate's latest piece she wrote with her colleagues called Anti-Choice March Madness, The Worst State for Women, an incredibly long and really exhausting piece to read, frankly, because it takes a look at all of the anti-choice laws that are passing across the country, and there is no possible way you can keep up. So be sure to check out that article. And also, we've been following the story of the former Guatemalan dictator José Efraín Ríos Montt, who went on trial this week for genocide and crimes against humanity. The 86-year-old ruled Guatemala for nearly 17 months during 1982 and 1983. He's on trial with José Mauricio Rodríguez Sánchez, his then chief of military intelligence. The charges arise from systematic massacres of the country's indigenous population carried out by Guatemalan troops and paramilitary forces during this phase of the country's long, brutal civil war. This marks the very first time a former dictator is on trial for genocide and crimes against humanity in the Americas. It's also the first time a former head of state is being prosecuted for genocide in a national as opposed to an international court. The U.S. government provided assistance to Montt and other Guatemalan military dictators that followed in that era. And several reports actually also mentioned Ronald Reagan's support for this dictator. Joining us to discuss media coverage is Gabby Cruz. She's a community radio activist, journalist, and broadcaster for Radio Guerrilla, and she joins us from Guatemala City. Hi, Gabby. Welcome to the show.
Hi. It's really a pleasure for us having a space there in your radio. And, this topic is really important, genocide case. As you already mentioned, it's very important for our history here in Guatemala and the Latin American history, too.
Yes.
So thank you for giving us this chance.
Well, we are very happy to have you directly from Guatemala City to talk about this important case. But before we do that, Gabby, we talk about good reporting this week. We give kudos to reporters who did a good job. So, Kate, why don't we start off with you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, like a lot of people, I was watching really closely what was going on in the Supreme Court with the gay marriage arguments this week. I really liked a piece out today from Gabriel Arana at the American Prospect, in which he sort of looked at people who are outside the court and talked to them and used that to sort of analyze where we're heading on gay marriage. And I thought it was a really great piece. And then my colleague Adam Server here at Mother Jones was also doing some fabulous reporting from the court this week. And I think that was the best stuff I saw.
And what did the American Prospect piece really focus on in terms of the people outside?
Well, the focus was more on looking at the anti-gay marriage crowd and basically assessing the fact that they're losing, and they realize that even if, you know, no matter what the court decides in these two big cases, they're being left behind. The American people are overwhelmingly changing their minds about gay marriage. And so he looks sort of at how that's affecting those people.
Yeah, and that actually came out in both Time Magazine, The New Yorker, a lot of media outlets. And we'll talk about that later in the show, about coverage of the gay rights cases in Washington. And we'll put those links on our website right after the show. And what about you, Gabby? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, this week I can say that, here in Guatemala, there is an effort, a collective effort, that is the community of independent and social journalists. And, here I can tell you that there is a journalist here, that is, his name is Rodrigo Vélez, and there he is making an effort writing a genocide chronicle. So according to the theme and the topic that we're discussing right now, and the one that I'm going to give you a little information, this genocide chronicles are part of the testimonies of the voice of the people, of the survivors and the witnesses during our work. So it rescues the people's voice.
Mm.
I think that's important for a journalist. I mean, like, what we can say and what we can say in the testimonies.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad you brought that up. And I'll ask you to talk about the witnesses in a couple minutes, Gabby, because it was amazing to read transcripts. And so many people were actually afraid to even speak in the courtroom. And they had to be told by the judge, don't worry, you're safe here. But before we do that, Gabby, why don't you give us just a little bit of context? Because this is such a historic moment, not only in Guatemala, but in the Americas, because it is the very first time that a former dictator is on trial for genocide in the Americas. So just give us some context here. Tell us about this former U.S.-backed Guatemalan dictator, José Efrén Ríos Mott.
Okay. Well, for the context, I can say Efrén Ríos Mott, he was a part of a military high command during the years of the 82 March, between March 82 and August of the 83. And as you know, the charges are genocide, and during this time, war crimes, as torture, forced disappearance, massacres, and sexual violation were committed against a Mayan region, that is Región Ixil, as in my native language, that's Ixil, that's one of the Mayan here, Mayan population, and some of the plans, the military plans that were committed during this time were Victory 82, that's Victoria 82, Firmeza 83, that's Firmes 83, Ixil Operation, and Sofia Operations Plan, which you already can find in the NSA, that's the National Security Archive, which is in the USA. According to those plans, all of them were consistent in the disappearance of the internal enemy that they considered this Mayan region, Ixil region, as internal enemies. So they, all of them consistent to disappear all the people. We can say in the massacres that were children, women, and men tortured and disappeared during this time.
And Gabby, I found a United Nations-sponsored Truth Commission report. It established under the peace agreement that ended the Civil War in 1996, estimated that more than 200,000 died or were subjected to forced disappearance during the 36-year conflict, over 80% from Mayan indigenous populations. And then specifically in 1982, this general is being tried on charges of genocide and crimes for killing just over 1,700 indigenous, I believe you say it's Ixils. Is that how you say it?
Ixil.
Ixil. In 1982 and 1983. And until recently, no one has been held accountable for these crimes. So how have the media in Guatemala covered this issue over the last couple of decades?
Well, actually, there was, as you mentioned here, the war ended in 1986. It was a 36th year of civil war between the years of 1960 and 1996. The media here, actually, we were, this being a really delicate topic here for everyone, like all the fear that we have as Guatemala, not as just a group of people. There is like the fear, and maybe like I can say that all the lies of our history. In a lot of the schools, for example, at university too, I can say, it's very difficult to talk about war in our times. Not to mention that right now we have this dictator in court. So not a lot of media cover the topic during this time. Efrain Reyes Montu, the dictator, he was part of Guatemala state. Too. I mean, like, in the government, he was part of a government for a long, long time. So impunity here is very, like, very, very difficult.
That is Gabby Cruz. She's a community radio activist, journalist, and broadcaster for Radio Guerrilla in Guatemala City. And we're speaking with her about coverage of the former U.S.-backed dictator, José Ríos Montt, who is on trial for genocide and crimes against humanity. He ruled Guatemala for 17 months starting in 1982. This is an historic case because it's the very first time that a former dictator is on trial for genocide in the Americas. Also the first time a former head of state is being prosecuted in a national as opposed to an international court. And Gabby will be with us for about 10 more minutes. So what are your thoughts on this? Have you heard about this? It has received coverage in the New York Review of Books, the New York Times, also on their editorial page. And what are your thoughts about the angle that this dictator was backed by the United States government? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And we're also joined by Kate Shepard, staff reporter and Mother Jones Washington Bureau. And Kate, I know you're not covering this at all. Have you even heard about this
trial? Well, sorry?
Yeah, have you heard about this trial this week in the media?
Sorry, I've heard a little bit, but not enough to weigh in intelligently.
Well, I'm just wondering what your thoughts are just about the U.S. role in this and how you think the media should cover it, because the New York Review of Books has a piece called Reckoning with Genocide by Arié Nier, and he writes, quote, "The prosecution of Ríos Montt is at least implicitly a repudiation of the policies of the Reagan administration, which was a resolute supporter of the Guatemalan dictator. Reagan himself and high State Department officials responsible for U.S. policy in Latin America denied Ríos Montt's abuses as they were taking place, abuses that included the killing of his forces of many thousands of poor Guatemalans. Reagan and his spokesman tried to basically shut up those who reported on these abuses as dupes of the left-wing guerrillas then fighting the Guatemalan government." What are your thoughts on this angle, and why do you think it got so little attention in the U.S., or is getting a little attention in the U.S.?
Well, I have not followed this case particularly closely, but I spent time in Nicaragua and in El Salvador years ago doing some reporting and studying there. And, you know, the story of Guatemala is a story we see in El Salvador and Nicaragua as well. You know, a lot that happened there in the 80s, we kind of have just forgotten or neglected here in the U.S., and we don't tend to, you know, when things happen like this trial, we just don't tend to go back to them and cover them here very closely. I mean, the majority of Americans just don't even, unless you were alive then, they probably have, you know, no idea that this even happened.
And what are your thoughts about this, Gabby, when you are following coverage of this, because it's receiving so much social media coverage, especially on Twitter? What are your thoughts about how this is being covered in the U.S. press?
Well, for the memory of the historical memory, it's very important that you can, like, well, it's kind of difficult because, as I was mentioning you, there's not a lot of fear here still in the population, and there we can say that there is a policy of silence. So in that, we can say that it's important that in U.S., right now we're having the space alive, for example, in this radio, and that a lot of people have taken pictures, and they were sending us pictures of, well, asking for justice in our country. So we can say that in solidarity work, for example, it's important, and that is important too, that the truth can be said, that the truth can be known.
So tell us just quickly, Gabby, about the witnesses, because it was amazing, especially to see so many Indigenous women take the stand and share their stories. And how is that being reported in the local media?
In the local media, that was the part that I mentioned at the beginning. We're writing here chronicles, genocide chronicles. So we're trying to rescue the testimonies, and in the part of the radio here, local radio, they're covering alive too. There is a independent media center here that you can find information in cmaguate.org, and there you can see every day a report of what's going on between the testimonies and the judges and what the people is expecting too. And in the news here, there is a very short part in the news, in the paper news, that they are covering the topic too. But it's something that I need to tell you too, and that I have this chance to let you know. Here, all the communication part, like newspaper, TV, and radio, are part of a certain group with certain and a specific thoughts, like they really don't mention, it's that they have some how can I say this? They're part of a military power too that is remaining here in Guatemala. As we can say right now, the president, Otto Perez Molina, he was part of the operations that I mentioned here. He was part there in the north of Quiché. Quiché is a place here. He was part of a military base there and is the president right now. So impunity here is very, very strong. That is why this is really important, that the genocide case is at the court now, and that we can finally, and the survivors and the witnesses, they can finally have a chance to say what happened, and that they need to tell their history of what they have, of what they live, and what military power in that day and now are still doing in the Mayan people, most of us.
And Gabby, before we let you go, you are a community broadcaster for Radio Guerrilla in Guatemala City. What is the state of the media in Guatemala?
Of media, well, we have the ring here. It's just it's a radio by internet. So the effort that we're doing in Radio Guerrilla is because we know that it's difficult to talk about these topics in national spaces, in national radio and national news. So that is why we decided to make this effort. And we started in January of last year, 2012, with this effort. And it's a radio by internet that we can say that we cover the not just the topic of historical memory, and all the topic that we have here that is really difficult with the mega projects, all the minery and hydroelectrics. We can say that here we're making an effort rescuing the testimonies, not just the ones that were during war and how can we relate those with the testimonies that we're having right now? All the communities are going to disappear due to this mega project. Mm. So in this effort, we're trying to make this a space so that people can say what's happening, what's going on here in Guatemala, like their reality of Guatemala.
Well, Gabby, you are doing such important work, and I'm so glad that you were able to join us. And keep it up. We'd love to have you back. We actually just got a phone call, Gabby, from a listener who says, please do a show on this and give these people, especially the indigenous population, a voice. So thank you so much, Gabby.
Thank you very much for your space, for your help, for your support. Honestly, this is very important for us, as I was telling you, because it's the first time that we can say that we live the word, that we're still living all of the conditions who remain during the war are still alive. We live them every day as racism and discrimination. Mm-hmm. And, all of these efforts in communication, independent communication, and the social journalists are important for the people, for the witnesses, the survivors, and for Latin America, I can say. And just if you give me a chance to give some of the blogs that we have in internet, or spaces that you can find information and set independent media centers.
Yeah, actually, you know what, Gabby, we've got a number of links on our website.
Great.
Yeah, so thank you so much.
Well, thank you then.
Okay, thank you. That is Gabby Cruz. She's a community radio activist, journalist, and broadcaster for Radio Guerrilla in Guatemala. And we've been speaking about José Ríos Montt. He ruled Guatemala for 17 months starting in 1982. A former U.S.-backed dictator. Ronald Reagan supported him. He's on trial for genocide and crimes against humanity. And because we are talking about Guatemala and President Obama's talking about immigration this week, be sure to see the film. We did a show about this a couple weeks ago, Harvest of Empire by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez, that takes a look at why so many people have immigrated to the United States and U.S. policies all across Latin America and Central America. So be sure to see that. I believe it'll be out on DVD soon. And we actually have just a couple of minutes before we go to break, but we're still joined by Kate Shepard. She'll be with us until the end of the show. Kate is a staff reporter in Mother Jones, Washington Bureau. And we're going to focus on domestic issues now and talk about what is happening in North Dakota and really across the country with so many anti-abortion laws being passed. And Kate, just quickly before we go to break, a lot of the media are saying that North Dakota's Republican governor signed the most restrictive abortion laws in the country. But one of these laws actually bans abortion as soon as a fetal heartbeat is detected. So isn't it fair to say that he's effectively banning abortion in the state?
I mean, in most cases, yes. 6 weeks is really early. That's before most women even realize that they're pregnant. So, I mean, in effect, yes. I mean, there could be some instances in which a woman could still have it if she qualified for that very, very narrow window. But, yeah, effectively, it is banning all abortions.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break and talk about this law along with all of the other laws that are being passed. Like I said, Kate and her colleagues have a new piece at Mother Jones called Anti-Choice March Madness, The Worst State for Women. And it goes through all the states and takes a look at all of these anti-choice laws that are passing. It's hard to actually even keep up. And we'd love to hear from you on this. What questions do you have about coverage of this? And what are your thoughts about media's coverage? It does get a lot of coverage, but have you seen it all in one article? I mean, this article that they wrote is really long because it looks at all of the states. And then we're also going to be speaking about media coverage of the gay rights cases in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and we'll be back after this.
All the stories you hear recommended on the Media Roundtable are posted at yourcallradio.org. And they're also included in Your Call's weekly email newsletter. It's free and easy to sign up for. Just click the email newsletter link at yourcallradio.org. KALW is supported in part by An Evening with David Sedaris. In celebration of his newest title, Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls, Sedaris will visit San Francisco's War Memorial Opera House Sunday, May 5th, for an evening of all new readings and recollections. Tickets and information at davidsedarisontour.com.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation with filmmakers Beth and George Gage about the documentary Bitter 70. This tells the story of environmental activist Tim DeChristopher. In 2008, he derailed the Bush administration's oil and gas leak lease auction. He bid $1.7 million, won 22,000 acres of land with no intention to pay or drill. He was sent to jail. He will be out soon after spending 18 months in prison. So the big question we're asking is, how should power be challenged? That's on Monday. And this film will actually be shown at the Human Rights Film Festival, kicks off on Friday at USF. It's an incredible film festival, and we'll be telling you more about that next week. And then also, next Thursday, we'll be joined by the incredible performance artist Rodessa Jones. She has a new piece at the Brava Theater called The Resurrection of She, and it takes a look at her ongoing work with disenfranchised populations around the world, including women inmates in Johannesburg, South Africa, and women who are HIV positive in San Francisco. And this play will be shown tonight through Sunday and then also next weekend. So try to see it over the weekend and then be sure to join us on Thursday. Today, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. And we're joined by Kate Shepard, staff reporter in Mother Jones, Washington Bureau. She has been closely following all of the anti-choice laws that are passing across the country. It is so hard to keep up. The recent one, or recent bills, I should say, were passed in North Dakota. One would essentially ban abortion because it bans abortion as soon as a fetal heartbeat is detected, something that can happen as early as 6 weeks. So if you've been following coverage of these very important stories and this ongoing, well, we can call it a war on women for sure. What are your thoughts about the coverage? We'd love to hear from you. And then also, if you have thoughts about coverage of the gay rights cases, we'll be talking about that shortly. And if there was a story that you saw that you'd like to talk about, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment, yourcallradio.org, or email us, feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Kate, tell us about the other bills. So one would ban abortion as soon as a fetal heartbeat is detected, something that would effectively ban abortion. What about the two other laws?
There are two other laws that they signed, that the governor signed this week. One bans so-called sex gender selection abortions, basically the idea being that, making it illegal to terminate a pregnancy if you don't want the gender of that child. The other is bans abortions because of fetal anomalies or genetic disorders. Basically, the idea is that they make it illegal to have an abortion if the fetus is found to have Down syndrome or some other significant impairment that might cause somebody to want to terminate the pregnancy. They also passed a bill that will put an issue on the ballot in 2014, and it will ask voters whether they should have so-called personhood in the state. Personhood is basically saying that a life begins at conception, and that at the point of conception, an embryo has all the rights of an adult human. Basically, that means that you could no abortions in any case, even from the point of conception. It could also put in peril some kinds of birth control that people falsely believe terminates a fertilized egg. And it could also impact in vitro fertilization as well. And so that now will go to voters in the 2014 election. And that's even more restrictive than the six-week ban. So basically, they've just sort of had just an all-out assault on access to abortion.
What I find fascinating, we spoke about this last time you were on the show, is when you look at the laws that are passed by these politicians versus the propositions that go to the voters. And since 2005, 10 out of 11 extreme laws have passed, have actually failed at the ballot box. And we're not talking about California. We're talking about South Dakota, Colorado, Mississippi. So it seems like, well, the data shows it. When you take these laws to the voters, they actually vote against them. But when the laws are put to the politicians, that's when they pass them. And I just don't really see the media looking at both of these. And I think it's really important to point this out. What are your thoughts on that?
You're right. It's absolutely imperative to point it out. South Dakota voters voted against it twice, and their legislators keep passing even more and more restrictive laws. Colorado's voted against it twice. Mississippi voted against it in 2011, and yet their lawmakers just keep finding other ways of trying to effectively ban abortion in the state without outright banning it. I think it's important to point that out because this idea that the people support it has not been shown when people actually go to the polls and vote on this.
Right. And we're speaking with Kate Shepard, staff reporter in Mother Jones Washington Bureau. I'd also like to welcome Lisa Keene to the show. Lisa is chief correspondent for Keene News Agency. This is an organization specializing in national political and legal issues affecting the GLBT community. Lisa has been reporting for the gay community since 1979. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. I can't wait to ask you later in the show just what this journey has been like for you since you've been reporting on these issues since 1979. But we're first spending some time on these extreme anti-choice laws. And I just wonder, as someone who's been in journalism for as long as you have, what are your thoughts? I mean, there are very interesting parallels between gay rights and women's rights, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But what are your thoughts about how the media are covering these anti-choice laws that are passing so quickly we can't even keep up with them?
I share your feelings that there are so many parallels between the political battles and the legal battles going on concerning choice and those concerning marriage. And it has always been such. I think the gay community has been tuned into particularly the legal battles all along, because a lot of the issues kind of are the same ones that we have to fight out. You know, what rights do you have as an individual to make certain choices about how you're going to live your life, whether you're going to have a baby or not at a particular time, or whether you're going to marry a particular person or not, and things like that. So, even the issues, I remember back where there was a dispute legally in the Supreme Court about whether protesters could protest within a certain amount of distance from a clinic that provided abortions. That if you'll remember, just last year, there was a case in the Supreme Court about how close an anti-gay group could protest near a funeral of someone.
Right.
So, I mean, there's just so many parallels. It's striking, and it just seems like endless. Like it will just go on. I want to be quick to add that I don't believe that the marriage issue is in as difficult a spot as the abortion issue is right now in terms of fighting this out at the ballot box. It feels like that public opinion is growing more and more strongly in the direction of allowing same-sex couples to marry and being okay with that. And there still seems to be a lot of conflict in the public, because the abortion issue gets broken down into a lot more different pieces, such as late-term abortion or, you know, whatever the various ways that people like to talk about it in order to...
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because it's interesting to look at media coverage of gay marriage. For example, Time magazine had two men kissing this mm-hmm. week, and then another cover, there were two women kissing.
Right.
And David Von Driel writes that thanks to a massive shift in public opinion, gay marriage went from inconceivable to inevitable in less than two decades. And Kate, when you look at the support for abortion, I mean, the Wall Street Journal had a poll a couple of months ago that looked at, I think it was 80% of the population supports Roe v. Wade, the highest percentage in a very long time. But why do we see this sort of opposite coverage of gay marriage and reproductive issues?
Well, I mean, I think the difference is on reproductive rights, it's, you know, women won the access to this 40 years ago. A lot of people assumed that it was something that was settled and done. for people who support it, there hasn't been anything to fight for. We've been, you know, it's been about maintaining this right that you've now been given. Whereas on gay marriage, people are psyched up. They're fighting for something new. They're, you know, it's a proactive battle. You know, people are engaged. And it's on the abortion side, for people who are pro-choice, it's not, there's not that same push to fight for anything. But you see that on the anti-abortion side, that they see that they're fighting against this now. They have a lot more enthusiasm because there is something they see a cause that they are organized behind, and which is to end abortion. So they are showing their power, especially at the state level, where they are where they're energized, where they're pushing on legislators who agree with them to pass laws. And they're finding ways to do that, below the sort of radar of national politics.
Do you think this is because it's very rare to hear in the national media that 80% of all U.S. counties have no abortion provider? Here in California, more than half of California's counties don't have an abortion provider.
No, I mean, the statistics are pretty startling. And if you look at, Mississippi, North Dakota, South Dakota, all three states only have one provider in the entire state. And these are pretty big states. The numbers around the country are shocking. And, I mean, if you look at it, there were a lot more clinics in the 80s in a lot of places. After Roe, a lot of them came into existence and then have been closed for a variety of reasons, whether that's because of state laws that have made it restrictive and hard to provide that care, or because of an atmosphere that has been hostile to abortion providers. You know, you can remember not that long ago when people were being shot, where clinics were being bombed. I mean, it's not been a pleasant atmosphere for a lot of people who are providers, and so it's in a lot of places made it really hard to find someone who would provide that care.
Can I jump in with an observation, too?
Please.
That I think, again, is a parallel between those who are fighting to defend the rights of women to make certain choices and the rights of gays to, exercise their rights in certain areas, is that in both cases, the opposition in both of those general areas, are what they're doing is they are fragmenting the fight and going after little pieces of the picture. For instance, on the gay side, it's not just trying to oppose marriage. They're also trying to break the issue down into a fragment that says that requiring open membership in a student club, that student clubs be open to everyone, violates the religious freedom of certain Christian-oriented student groups. One of the tricks they're employing here is just continue to break down the argument in ways so that they're fighting on like 50 different battlefronts and different segments, and they're trying to find the winning segment, trying to find something that the public will agree with, that, maybe it's easier for the public to agree that a student group that is an evangelical student group shouldn't be required to allow a gay student to run for office for that student group. I mean, I think it's easier to get the public there than it is to get the public to a place where the public, I don't believe the public would say that a gay person should not be able to visit their partner or spouse in a hospital. So what they do is they just chop the issue down into as many fronts as they can, and they're pushing on all of them. So yes, Roe v. Wade established the right for women to choose whether to have a certain procedure or not 50 years ago, but the opponents are just chopping it up and finding other ways to battle this out and try to make inroads that way. So in both issue areas, the people who support the individual's rights have to be vigilant and fighting on so many fronts.
That is Lisa Keene, chief correspondent for the Keene News Agency, an organization specializing in political and legal issues affecting the GLBT community. And Lisa's been reporting for the gay community since 1979. Kate Shepard is a staff reporter in Mother Jones, Washington Bureau. And we'd love to hear from you. There are really interesting parallels when you look at these two issues, and that's why we decided to bring Kate and Lisa on together. What are your thoughts about how these issues are covered in the media What stands out for you when Lisa talks about all of these groups coming at these issues from very different directions? You've got mostly Republicans, but also some Democrats who vote for these anti-choice laws, knowing that they're unconstitutional, but wanting them to be brought up in court and possibly even going to the Supreme Court. So what are your thoughts about how the media cover these issues? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What stood out for you when you heard radio reports or saw TV reports about the gay rights cases in D.C. and then specifically these laws that just passed in North Dakota? You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Diane in Castro Valley. Hi, Diane. Welcome to the show.
Hi, it's Castroville.
Oh, Castroville. Sorry.
Around Monterey and Salinas. With regard to the media, I sent a letter to the Monterey County Herald several days ago. They haven't printed it yet, and I doubt seriously if they will. I said, this just in, Republican politicians and Catholic bishops really are pro-choice, back alley butchers or wire coat hangers. And for young women who think they're too cool to call themselves feminists, they should ask their grandmothers about pre-1973 America. I have personal knowledge of a woman who used a wire coat hanger. My sister-in-law walked in on her in a pool of blood. She was a neighbor when my sister-in-law was a teenager. This happened back in the late 50s or early 60s. I believe the woman died, but I don't remember that for sure. But this type of abortion is not a myth. It actually happened. And I think that is the way we are going to go. And I want to make one other comment, please.
Sure.
These Republican politicians, and there really is a war on women, I honestly believe that if any of them had a blonde-haired, blue-eyed daughter or wife who was raped and impregnated by a member of another race or ethnic group, they would get that female to an abortion clinic so fast it would make your head swim.
Well, you know, Diane, you bring up a great point, because I was in Jackson, Mississippi about 5 or 6 years ago at the only clinic in that state, and counselors told me about the very story that you just described. They said that does happen, but the stories rarely, if ever, are told in the media. And Kate, I think Diane brings up a great point. You were also at that clinic. We had you on when you wrote that great piece about the clinic in Jackson. Mm-hmm. What I've loved about the coverage this week is there have been so many great stories about gay couples, Edie and Thea, for example. This documentary about their case was on Democracy Now! Yesterday. This is the couple that's behind the defense of marriage case. But when you look at these anti-abortion laws, you know, in Mother Jones and Alternet and the independent media, they tend to sometimes tell the stories of the women, but it's very rare in the national media. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think there are two factors. One is that, I mean, in general, you know, I'm 28. I'm one of the people who was not around pre-Roe. We don't remember those stories of the time before Roe, and maybe don't do enough to put those stories out there, and so other people know what that was like. Older people do remember that, but you know, people of my generation don't. So I think that's one of the challenges. And another challenge is that in general, because abortion is so stigmatized in the U.S., most women who have gone through those experiences are not comfortable speaking out. They don't want that intrusion into their personal life. They don't want to become targets of people who are against abortion. They're made to be very uncomfortable about sharing those stories. I think there are a lot of great efforts out there. There's the 1 in 3 campaign, which is basically getting, you know, publicizing the fact that 1 in 3 women will have an abortion and getting them to talk about their experiences. I think those are great. I mean, I think that a big part of the challenge is about destigmatizing abortion and making it clear about how many women use this and how many women have been affected by this in their life. I think it's important.
Yeah, and we just need more reporters to go to these clinics, especially where they only have one or where the doctors fly in, because the stories are just really unbelievable. And Lisa, since you've been covering gay rights since 1979, I'm sure you remember what it looked like back in 1972 during the Supreme Court decision on Roe.
Yeah, I do, although I have to say I wasn't covering the court at that time. I just remember, you know, all the attention given to it. I what I thought of when Diane was speaking was that my biggest criticism of the media on either of these issues is the careless choice of words media often use that I think bias an audience, a news audience, that isn't as tuned in to an issue as well as the people who are most affected by the issue. For instance, the media still is way too flippant in its use of the word the term pro-abortion, or, you know, there's nobody is pro-abortion. But that's not the issue. The issue is your ability to be able to decide for yourself whether you're going to have a certain medical procedure or not. That's why, you know, thank heavens the movement made it clear very early on. This is about having the right to choose what you're going to do with your body. It's not about whether you are for abortion or against abortion. And the gay movement faces the same thing very early on. And this is still a problem for the gay movement, frankly, is that the media tends to refer to things as gay marriage and gay rights, and to the undiscerning public who isn't gay and doesn't live and breathe this issue every day like a gay person does, they might kind of get in their mind that there is such a thing as gay marriage or gay rights, and there's not. What there is that there are rights that all citizens share, but the gay people are being walled off from. And there is the right to marry, which a male-female couple can in most states, or in every state, go and get a marriage license, but which same-sex couples are not allowed to. And I think that's my biggest criticism of the media is when and I understand, because I write for newspapers and always have, and I've done radio before, and I know you've got to get things in a short amount of time and a short amount of space, and not only that, but let's face it, all readers are becoming short attention span readers now anyway. You know, you do have to take shortcuts, but I think there's a price we pay for those shortcuts, that there's a subliminal message going out that, you know, kind of confuses and distorts the real issue in people's minds.
Yeah, it's such a great point, Lisa. I mean, since this got so much attention this week, I think the Time magazine cover, The New Yorker's Jeffrey Toobin writes that the hearings are just sideshows. He says, quote, "The larger point was clear. Times have changed. Gay people deserve changes in the law now. That's why we have courts." So what are your thoughts about how the media put in context what you just said about the fact that saying, just repeating gay marriage and gay rights over and over again is maybe not the best choice of words?
Not the best choice of words. But I forgive them liberally, and I'll tell you why. It's because I have been reporting on gay issues since 1979. I remember back then, and before AIDS really hit, that news organizations other than gay newspapers never covered gay-related issues. And there were a lot back then. Mm-hmm. So for years and years and years, nobody covered gay issues except these weekly gay newspapers like Bay Area Reporter and Windy City Times in Chicago and other like that. You know, and so I have to say that even though I'm jostling for position to get into the Supreme Court to observe the most historic cases that I have ever covered in my 30-plus years in covering gay issues, it hardens me to have to be fighting for a seat in that courtroom because there are so many media who want to be in there to cover this issue and to get the word out. And I believe that they are doing as fair a job as they can. I mean, sometimes it annoys the heck out of me when they seem to, you know, walk all the way down to the end of the mall to try to find somebody who opposes allowing gay people to marriage.
Right.
But I get why they're doing it, because they do want to seem like that they are trying to be as fair and balanced as possible. And, you know, if the public is overwhelmingly in support of marriage for same-sex couples, it's more difficult to find people who are on the other side. But, you know, I get why they do it. So, you know, like I said, it's something that I really appreciate You know, I don't think any media, including my own, we're not perfect. We don't always get it exactly right, or we don't always get the whole picture. But I think that overall, the media is doing a very good job.
And in our remaining minutes, Lisa, where do you think this is going in the future, especially around media coverage? Because, you know, you don't really still have that much coverage of what's happening in the trans, bisexual communities.
Right.
The New Yorker, I just want to give kudos to Rachel Aviv. She had this amazing piece called Netherland, looking at the fact that 40% of the nation's homeless youth are LGBT. She looked at a lot of young LGBT kids who are basically thrown out of their homes because their parents disagree with their choices, and they end up in New York City on the streets. And so I think it's important to also point out some of these other angles, not just the marriage issue. Do you think that these issues will get more coverage in the months to come?
I think eventually. You know, what you've got is the phenomenon in the media of the herd mentality. You know, some of the big media decide to start covering marriage, and everybody's covering marriage, and
right.
That's what's happening right now, and it is herd mentality. Eventually, once that issue starts being resolved in big ways, and I don't know that it will necessarily this time around, but once it starts getting resolved, then I think that we will be able to persuade the mainstream media to begin to look at other issues like that, which are equally important, so very important. As you know, we recently began to get a lot more attention for the issue of bullying.
Yes.
And bullying really has often, very often, been a problem for LGBT youth. So the fact that we're beginning to get media interested in that and getting them to start to do things about that will really improve people's lives. So I'm glad for that, but it's herd mentality. You see it all the time.
And Kate, final thoughts from you. North Dakota, the governor knows that this law is going to be taken up in the courts. Where does this go from here?
I think the part of the point for them is that they want this to be taken up in the courts. And I think that's the point of abortion opponents across the country, is to try to force something back into the national level. I am, you know, very anxiously awaiting what will rise to the Supreme Court level again in the next few years.
Wow.
I mean, this one's an obvious candidate, but these 20-week bans, and there's a 12-week ban in Arkansas. I mean, all of these are going to end up in the court system.
Well, we are definitely going to do a show about this. Kate Shepard is a staff reporter in Mother Jones, Washington Bureau. I should say another show about this. Lisa Keene has been covering gay issues, gay rights for the gay community since 1979. She's a chief correspondent with the Keene News Agency. Thank you both so much for joining us.
You bet.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. Here's what's coming up on Your Call on Monday. What happens when citizens challenge the U.S. government's power structure? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with filmmakers Beth and George Gage about the film Bitter 70, which tells the story of Tim DeChristopher. In 2008, he derailed the Bush administration's oil and gas lease auction. He bid $1.7 million and won 22,000 acres of land with no intention to pay or drill. He was sent to jail and will be released soon. So how should power be challenged? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on, and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.